Mini episode 162 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Royalty Tours USA, your ultimate resource to traveling in style to attend sporting events. Follow them on the web at royaltytours.blogspot.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Okay, folks, welcome to mini episode number 162 of the FDH Lounge. It's a true pleasure to welcome back to the program. We had him on in, I believe, November of 2010. We did it via phone, but today in New York, he is gracious enough to be speaking with us in his home. Political commentator and author Ellis Hennigan from Fox News, Newsday, and several other outlets as well, and voiceover artist, and I'm probably forgetting five different things here. But Ellis, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show, sir. Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, great to be here. You know, in this economy, we all need, like seven jobs, right?
That's very efficient.
If I were getting paid enough for any one of them, this wouldn't be an issue, right? Welcome to town, though. Nice to see you here.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, these are very tough times, and I guess we should start there, it being the heat of a presidential race and all. And we are only a couple weeks out from the start of the two conventions. Of course, the Republican one going first, and in all likelihood, prior to that, if the rumors are to be believed, Mitt Romney names a running mate. Any sense at the moment of the leading contenders? It's thought that Rob Portman, Tim Pawlenty are probably the leading guys, but if he's daring, maybe he goes for Paul Ryan or Bobby Jindal or somebody. Do you have any real sense at the moment of which way they might be going?
I mean, I think you gave the pretty good rundown. Marco Rubio, I would add to the list, at least of possibles, but I would suggest that chances are Rubio gets shoved aside. Bobby Jindal gets shoved aside. You know, in the end, you're probably talking about Portman or Pawlenty. Neither one of whom is risky, but neither one of whom, frankly, is all that exciting.
No. I mean, you're basically doubling down on what the top of the ticket is in going that direction. And again, Rob Portman is actually my home state senator, so I follow that with some degree of interest. I've always been skeptical of his chances just because, again, I know that, and you know this very well, that the Democrats would love to tie anything back to the George W. Bush years, and Portman presents kind of a ripe target in that way. Or does he? Is it possible to make too much of him being the OMB director and the trade representative under Bush?
No, it does come up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, you can make a good argument that, well, Ohio is such an important state. It truly is one of the probably two or three states that are going to determine who the next president is. And it's certainly not true that the vice presidential nominee is someone who is going to deliver a state automatically or will swing an election. But, you know, it can't hurt. He's fairly popular back at home. And he is a grown-up. I mean, I think you have to give him that much, is that he's a, you know, he's a smart guy. He's basically sane. He's got a political philosophy that, you know, it doesn't give you the willies when you listen to it, as frankly I think some other folks out there do. So he could, I mean, Romney could do a lot worse than that.
Well, the interesting thing is, and this is where when you start to look at the candidates here, how they contrast with the top of the ticket, for somebody like Rob Portman, who, aside from perhaps trying to pose as a little bit of a smaller spender than the George W. Bush years would indicate, is fairly consistent with what he's talking about versus somebody like Mitt Romney. Is that something that might be a consideration internally, that if you have a vice president who appears to be too plain-spoken, it might be a contrast with the image of the top of the ticket?
You know, that's a good point. But again, this is why this analysis in advance is so tough, because you can make – the point you made is absolutely correct and is a good one. But you could also say, and this does also factor into the calculation, that – if you ask what Romney needs, one of the key things he needs is someone that the base of the Republican Party is going to feel comfortable with.
Yes.
Someone who's steady, someone, you know, what he believes. He's not likely to change next week. And that's a problem that Romney has, because he's been all over the map. He's had a series of different jobs and different attitudes. So I think when you come down to it, that while the passion might be with a Bobby Jindal or a Rubio or someone who is identified more as a Tea Party kind of favorite, I think in the end you go with tried, true, and maybe even a little boring.
I would tend to believe that that would be the way they would be looking to go, just based on his past history. I would tend to agree with your assessment on that. But as far as it goes with Romney and the passion that you talked about and exciting the base, I have to tell you, I mean, I've been surprised personally at the extent to which that's really been taken care of. For a guy whose track record is anything but Tea Party, folks like myself on the right who are not going to vote for him but are going to go third party, I hardly see anybody looking in that direction. Everybody is so excited to vote for the Republican ticket, and it puzzles me. I wonder if it puzzles you to the same extent here, that this man has been able to capture the base without a career that really indicated trying to capture the base in 2012.
Without doing too much for him.
Yeah.
It's true. But, you know, you make a mistake in politics, I think, if you ignore the stereotypes.
Okay.
Right? Because there are groups in our society. We still divide, even though we have this modern society where we're all mobile and ethnicity maybe doesn't matter like it once did, and we all watch the same TV shows. But in the end, people do, most of them, gather in very traditional groups. So, for instance, African Americans may have some issues with Barack Obama, but mm-hmm. the vast majority of them are going to vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're hearing from Jewish voters right now a lot of complaints about Obama and some of his Middle East policies.
Mm-hmm.
We know in the past, it's not going to be 95%, but a high majority of Jewish voters in the end are going to be voting for Barack Obama. And then, you know, you go on the other side, and if it's evangelical Christians or it's other parts of the Republican base, you know, they all just kind of tend to come home.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing the extent to which, yeah, I never would have thought during the primaries it would have been possible.
People
obviously
are mad, right?
Mad. Yeah.
Right? You're like, hey, they're selling out too cheap here.
Yeah.
Come on, get something, guys. Demand something.
How Mitt Romney gets the aura of being a winner when it took, what, 9 figures worth of sludge that he had to dump on Newt Gingrich just to win Florida? And again, the thing that was amazing at the time, Ellis, I thought in looking at this, was there's nothing that he used to win the Republican primaries that is going to be relevant to what it takes to beat Obama. I mean, they may have
money.
A cash advantage at
money.
The end,
yeah.
maybe at the
yeah.
end. Yeah. But they haven't had a cash advantage thus far. Obama has, you know, maintained parity on the airwaves. And even if they have a cash advantage in October and November, it won't be as much as the one that they had over Gingrich. So it's amazing that he was able to get the aura of a winner in such a way, isn't it?
Yeah. I think you're right. But he did win a lot of primaries in the end, and it was not quick, but steadily. Mm-hmm. He piled up those delegates. And I think that the establishment of the Republican Party, mm-hmm. not nearly as powerful as they once were. We just saw in Texas and other places where they don't seem to have the oomph they once did. But, you know, they made a judgment that, mm-hmm. listen, in the long run, the passion might be with the Bachmans and the Santorums and the Gingriches, but do you really want to run someone like that against Barack Obama? And I think the regulars decided, nah, we're more comfortable with Mitt.
Yeah, I think so as well. Before I pivot to asking you about the Democratic side here, I have a note from our producer, Steve Cervillo, to bring up a name that we didn't mention in the Veep stakes here, and the fact that he didn't come up is probably because he's not on the radar. Chris Christie, is he completely off the radar of it at this point?
I think he's pretty much taken himself out mm-hmm. of it. He is a beloved figure. He's one of the few people in the party that really can rally people across the mm-hmm. Republican spectrum at this point, maybe even bring in a few Dems. It's interesting to me why it is that ran out of gas as a genuine possibility so quickly. And I don't think we know the answer to that. I mean, there's a lot of speculation, a lot of, you know, maybe health issues, maybe other stuff mm-hmm. made him reluctant to proceed. Inexperience was what he would say. But I don't think we have the full story there yet.
No, I wouldn't think so either. Yeah, there does seem to be more than meets the eye to that. On the side of the spectrum for which you, Ellis, personally have more affection here, the side with Barack Obama at the top of the ticket in this year's race. Thus far, everything seems to be looking pretty good for the president in the swing states. Narrow but steady leads going through. A little bit of trepidation in the ranks, perhaps looking ahead, as we alluded to, October and November and what things are going to be like then with the monetary advantage and what the super PACs are able to do. But at this stage of the game, is this not as good as an incumbent president could expect, given the still rotten state of the economy?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because, yeah, I mean, that's probably right. If unemployment is going to be in the 8.2, 8.3 area, and too many people still looking for work, and those who have jobs are worried whether they're going to lose them and see that income isn't going up, you know, you can have the debate all day about what caused that.
Mm-hmm.
And how much of that is a hangover from the Bush years, how much of it is cyclic stuff, how much of it you blame on the current guy. But, you know, it's tough to run for re-election when you have an economy that people aren't happy with. And we've got one of those right now. I have believed all along that Barack Obama was beatable in 2012 for the reasons you mentioned. But I don't know that Mitt Romney's the guy who can do it. I think he has personal problems as a candidate. I think he doesn't connect comfortably with people, in a way even that George W. Bush did. Certainly not nearly as well as Barack Obama does. And the rich guy stuff, the Bain Capital things, the reluctance to release the taxes, all that stuff, not that any one of them is something that alone would swing an election. But, you know, we're not only voting for policies when we elect the president. Mm-hmm. We're voting for who it is we want to have hanging around in our lives for the next 4 years. And I don't think Mitt has made that sale yet. And I think that, so you're left with an equation. Does the lackluster economy in the end matter most? Or does, which one of these guys do you trust and do you want to have around? And I think, you know, if you have to guess right now, it's going to be real tight. It might even go back and forth a couple of times. But in the end, I'm still betting on Barack.
Yeah, I would tend to think so, looking at the way that things are right now, for all the reasons you mentioned, because of Mitt Romney's characteristics as a candidate, his inability to connect with people better than he has. And in looking ahead to this race also, too, there is the specter. Again, on the Democratic side, there had been a year and a half ago, I know, some degree of dissatisfaction from within about the way that this presidency has gone. But much as I've been surprised by the rallying around on the Republican side, you seem to be seeing the same thing on the Democratic side. Is it because the further we get that Obama is running a more populist campaign and that he's speaking more along the lines of what his base would like to hear relative to how he's governed? What kind of accounts for the fact that everybody seems to have come home on his side of the spectrum?
Where the hell else are they going to go?
Okay.
I mean, seriously, when you get right down to it, you know, yeah, the people on the left don't think he's done enough and wish he'd done, you know, more on this issue or that issue. But, you know, are they going to vote for Romney?
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to stay home? You know, you worry about that a little bit. But in the final analysis, people pretty much stay on the side of the street that they're most comfortable. And the turnout numbers aren't that different from election to election. And the notion that somebody, someone who thinks that Obama is inadequately liberal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Put yourself, if you can, in the mindset of someone who feels like that, right?
One of the guys in our crew who's a liberal thinks
right.
that, yes.
Right. And, but he's not going to say, okay, I'm going to exercise my frustration by voting for this guy who's 100 times less liberal. So I just think in the end, when we have this political system, the vast majority of which remains still in the control of two big, fat, frustrating parties, that, you know, most people line up with one of them in the end.
Well, that's really been true. Yeah, and you're right about that, and you're right about people finding the choices and ultimately going with the guy on their side. That's what it seems to be coming down to. And taken together from what you've said about the Republican side and about the Democratic side, I'm guessing that you would be expecting more of a traditional map along the lines of 2000 and 2004 relative to what we saw in 2008. Are we returning to that? Are we returning to something that's going to be relatively close to 50-50 and maybe by the end of the game not that many states being decided here, just a handful of swing states? Or do you think it could be more expansive like 2008?
No, I think it's likely to be back to the one you're talking about, where it's going to be Ohio and we're going to be looking at Florida late into the night and, you know, keep an eye on Nevada, and, you know, maybe a couple of others thrown in. But, you know, the frustrating thing, I mean, you're lucky being in Ohio because you're right in the middle of it. I mean, people are, believe me, you're gonna, your television is going to be burning with ads and the radio as well.
It's been for 2 months, almost. Right. Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to, hopefully it's going to keep some journalists in Ohio working, right, to pay those big fat salaries in the radio business out there, right? But that's where the race is. And so if you're somewhere like I am, living in New York, or like my home state of Louisiana, which are totally foregone conclusions in the opposite direction, but you're not going to see that much of an election this November. You know, you're being written off by both sides. Why spend your money in Louisiana? There's no way Barack Obama's going to take Louisiana any more than Mitt Romney's going to take New York.
Right.
And so the election really is, it's a handful of, depending on how you look at it, very lucky or very unlucky Americans.
Well, having been subjected to the barrage as I have over a period of time, it's very interesting because I would like to get your sense in looking at the nuts and bolts of this, as I know that you do. Everybody's looking to move the needle right now, but do you really think it's that important to move the needle to take a slight lead, say, in early August as opposed to later on, and particularly if you're the Obama side and you are potentially using up your funds at this period of time and being prone to being outspent down the stretch? It strikes me as wasteful. You're just looking at the same ads for 60 days, 90 days, but do they know what they're doing? Do they know better than I do that this is having an effect and you need to keep pounding like this and, you know, take it day by day by day all the way to the election? Because that seems to be the approach that they're taking, fight every day.
Well, it is a marathon. You've got to keep it going all the way until the day before people vote. But one thing to remember is that the impressions that are being created now, the effort that both sides are making to define their guy and even perhaps more importantly to define the other guy, that kind of gets baked in at this time of the year. And so, you know, if you look at Michael Dukakis, say, in 1988, right, where he was in these months, right about now, kind of portrayed as this kind of, you know, wimpy, hapless, kind of clueless guy, never able to overcome that, no matter what efforts he made. And you know, the Ronald Reagan was able to seal a notion when he first ran that he was someone that connected with people. So I do think that you make a mistake saying, let him slam me now without answering it. And then you'll be defined as some bad thing. You know, I mean, Mitt, in a way, is being defined as the, you know, as the aloof rich guy playing every angle for his rich buddies. And I think he's got to answer that.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned about Dukakis. You're looking at three times in the last quarter century now of guys from Massachusetts being defined negatively midsummer, and it may be sticking. The Dukakis thing is kind of infamous when he coughed up the 17-point lead in 1988 because of the Pledge of Allegiance and the other things. John Kerry with the Swift voting in 2004, and now Mitt Romney with Bain Capital here. It's, I mean,
all defined, right? All defined in these months,
right?
You know, kind of before and after the convention,
as
people that most Americans in the end said, "Man, I don't know if I want to be with that guy." And it's right. It's a fascinating thing. Frankly, I'm a little jealous of you in Ohio. I like being in the middle of that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't want that going on the other side of the nation somewhere. Thankfully, in the in our media life, there is no local in a lot of ways. But that psychological and political process unfolds every day, every hour.
Yeah.
And it is the reason that those of us who are fascinated by this stuff and enthusiastic about it and enjoy arguing it and debating it back and forth, you know, why it stays interesting.
Well, and to bring it full circle on the race, too, are we not looking at something that is going to be, I mean, maybe not exactly unprecedented, but extraordinarily rare, whether it be Obama getting elected with an economy like this or Mitt Romney getting elected essentially purely in opposition to the other candidate there, as opposed to an affirmative choice that voters are making? I want this guy to be president. It's pretty clear at this point that if Romney wins, it's just going to be because there's enough Obama fatigue out there. It's been rare, if almost non-existent, for somebody to win when they trail in the likability as Mitt Romney does. So one way or another, are we not looking at something for which there's not a lot of precedent?
Yeah, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. And you can stack up those statistics. We can, believe me, I can make every one of these races sound sound historically unique and never before. As, you know, I mean, last time around they told me a black guy couldn't get elected.
Well,
president.
Yeah.
You know, it turned out that wasn't right, you know? I mean, and you know, it really had never happened before.
Well, that's true.
Nobody ever came close, but, you know, there he is, right? So,
yeah.
You know, can a hedge fund zillionaire who won't show you his taxes be president? I don't know. I mean, they hadn't had too many before. I'll admit that.
Yeah. Again, yeah, a guy completely without the common touch, and it's really hurting him at this point. But, again, I know that, you know, this is something that you've been on top of covering with Newsday and with Fox News. But what are some of the other interesting things that you've been looking at in some of your columns? I think I read that you'd written about the Colorado shooter recently you know, some of his issues there. So what have been some of the column material you had recently?
Well, you know, for me, it's always a mix. I mean, I kind of get hurled myself on the newspaper column, kind of at whatever the momentary story is. Mm-hmm. And I just... You know, sometimes it's something that I have a lot of background on and know a lot about. Sometimes it's something I come to with complete and total ignorance when the day begins. And I like it. I mean, I've got a short attention span, and I'm interested in a lot of stuff. So, you know, I have no apologies. You know, one day I'll be writing about, you know, Britney's dating life, and the next day it'll be the war in Iraq, and then I'll be, you know, back at the Trampire, you know. And I just think it's interesting. If you can get people, regular folks, to become engaged in what's going on in the world around us, and it's not easy because this stuff is complicated, it's riven with hard feelings and ideological manipulation, but if you can tell these stories in a way that just regular folks can connect to them, care about them, and understand how it is that it intersects with their own lives, I feel like you've done a good day's work, and when I write a column or I do a radio show or a TV hit over at Fox, and I feel like we've come out of it and I've gotten people not necessarily to agree with everything I think, not to say, oh, that Henneken guy is the you know most brilliant analyst I've ever run across, but basically to feel like we just sat down at the best diner or dinner table conversation and had a really spirited debate, made us think, made us open our minds a little bit to stuff that we hadn't thought of in the same way. I can't think of anything better to do in my life. I didn't realize as a kid, I mean, I grew up in a big family, I'm the oldest of five, big Catholic family down in New Orleans, and that's how we lived it. Every night at dinner, we were arguing about stuff and debating things and poking and one-upping and, you know, trying to be funny and smart-alecky. And I didn't realize that was a job. I didn't know you could get paid money for that. And, you know, I really truly consider myself fortunate to have been able to take the dinner time conversation on Jefferson Avenue and Ferret Street in New Orleans and turn that into, you know, a career that at least saved me from having to do honest work.
Yeah, well, you know, it's great to be able to leverage it like that, you know. And speaking of, you know, New Orleans growing up there, you know, as we discussed a little bit off air, the situation with your hometown football team this year. I know you'd written a book previously you'd been involved with home team, coaching the Saints in New Orleans back to life, Sean Payton's book that he collaborated on with you. I don't want to get into anything too sensitive for you to talk about because I know there are probably things that you're privy to that you shouldn't be saying, but what is your sense of what the Saints are going to be going through this year? Anything that you feel that you can put out there on the record as far as what lies ahead for this team and what would be? We joked about unprecedented, but this is kind of an unprecedented football season for them.
Anyway, first of all, I'll talk about anything. I have no standards about that.
So. Okay.
You know, Sean and I did that book together, and it did great. And truly, I mean, the story of the Saints coming back, you know, from Katrina, this busted city and downbeat team coming and going all the way to the Super Bowl, I think a story that really did grip a lot of people, and I was proud to be part of it. Yeah, Sean's in the, you know, he's in the middle of a jam, accused of this bounty scandal. The team, I have to tell you, I think they're looking under the circumstances pretty good. I'm not. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can write them off. I mean, you could think of all these reasons why it is they should be distracted, but the Drew Brees is a world class, historic level quarterback. Mm-hmm. He is a leader on that team that is there are very few teams that you can find that have a quarterback, not only who is as technically proficient, but is as charismatic and clean a leader as Drew is. The coaching staff that that Sean put together, that's running the joint now, some pretty impressive people. And I'm not I don't say, hey, they're going to win the Super Bowl again. Not only anybody can know that. But, you know, I don't think they're going to win three games this season. I think they're going to be, you know, a solid contender in the, you know, in the South. I think they very well may win that division. And, hey, they can play some fun football, I think.
Is there any fallout so far as you can see from Drew Brees' contract situation in terms of tangible on the field matters, partially because they had to keep the dollars flexible. They end up losing a Pro Bowl guard in the process, Drew's protection may not be as good. But do you get the sense that there's any other ramifications coming out of that, or is this one of these deals where, okay, he's signed, he's in there, and we're kind of putting it all behind us?
Well, what choice do you have, really? I mean, he's the guy who's going to lead this team, and yes, he's expensive, and yes, you got to give up some stuff to get him. You know, you want the line to be as strong as possible. But let me tell you, the guy can scramble in the backfield. I mean, he has these little moves, these little micromatics, squiggles that somehow or another he's able to. The geometry of that man's body is a phenomenal thing. You know, who knows is the honest answer. But I would say that I am feeling cheerier here in early August than I kind of would have expected. As the contract dragged on, as the bounty thing swung out of control, as Sean was booted back to a year of penance in Dallas, you know, all that stuff was certainly rattling to someone who cares about that football team. But, you know, seriously, we're gonna be talking in the fall at some point, and I hope I'm going to be able to tell you, hey, come on, they didn't do too bad, did they?
No, I would think that they're probably not going to fall off a cliff. And again, Drew Brees' attributes, I certainly agree with you on them. He being one of the key guys who helped deliver me personally a fantasy football championship last year with that record-breaking season.
Thank
you,
Drew.
Got to give credit to Megatron also and Mo Jones Drew. But yeah, Drew Brees played a role. Tremendous, tremendous player. Yeah, what was he, like 70%, I think, completion percentage
last
year? It's
amazing. And they do all those new statistics, and you know better than I do, of these highly complex mathematical equations. But all I notice is he seems to come out pretty high in most of them.
He really does. He does. As far as, you know, sports and other matters, entertainment, I know you've got some voiceover work that you've been doing also, and I think we talked about that a little bit last time you were on, but how does that basically fit in with everything else that you've got going on? That's got to be something that's a nice little creative side outlet away from all the real-world things that you're enveloped in.
Well, you know, again, it comes back to what we were talking about earlier. In this industry, if you're going to if you're going to be a writer and a talker, which are basically, it seems, the only two marketable skills that I have, nobody's asking me for stock tips, and nobody wants to buy shoes from me, right? So I got to ride those babies for a long time, right? I'm not anywhere near retirement. If you look at my 401k, you will understand I'm going to be a 107 before I can think about that. But so my attitude is that I ought to, in this career, be very open to a lot of different stuff. I assume that over the course of the years, I'm going to be doing a variety of things under those two big umbrellas. And I'm not a snob. You know, so when the folks at the Cartoon Network said, hey, we've got this role in C-Lab 2021. Do you want to be in it? With Eric Estrada, and I'm like, really? That was a guy from Chips, right?
You were like, is this a rhetorical question?
I'm like, well, yeah, why not? You know, I mean, some of my, you know, agents and stuff, like, I don't know, you know, we're trying to build you up as a responsible political pundit. Do we really want you as a cartoon voice? I'm like, come on, it'll be fine. And it's been the same for me. I mean, I, you know, I've never been a sports reporter. And so the notion that I would write a book with Sean Payton, or then the next one I did, which was with Michael Waltrip, who's a NASCAR guy that did great in the blink of an eye. And I'm just literally, as we speak, have turned in the first draft of a new book that I think folks will be interested in that involves the world of the Navy SEALs.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. Please elaborate a little bit. I'm looking forward to it.
Well,
yeah.
It's something totally different from me. I mean, I'm not a... You know, a military guy, really. But here's how it came about. Let me give you the backstory for a second. There was a movie that some folks may remember that came out earlier this year called Act of Valor.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a, you know, a shoot 'em up action military movie, a great looking movie. But the gimmick in it, I guess gimmick is a fair word, is that instead of Hollywood actors, it stars active duty Navy SEALs in mm-hmm. all the main roles. There's some Hollywood people in some of the supporting roles. But it's, you know, a fiction movie, big budget, Hollywood, well, medium budget Hollywood movie.
Mm-hmm.
And but they put real SEALs in these roles.
Okay.
So they act out all the stuff they were doing. A lot of it is shot and with live fire and genuine training exercises. And I have teamed up with a guy who is the star of that movie, who is a guy named Lieutenant Commander Rourke Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And Rourke, for the last 4 years, has been the head of training for the SEALs. And he knows better than anybody in the world how it is that you create these modern warriors, right? We want guys, a new breed of military men. After Iraq and after Afghanistan, I think, and this is me talking, not Rourke, but I think that most Americans are tired of these wars that go on forever. They take hundreds of thousands of people. The results are kind of murky when mm-hmm. we're done. Wouldn't it be better if instead of spending a decade in Iraq, we could send in six elite, really trained guys, have them kill three people and leave?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think that's the special forces goal and image, and truly what those guys do better than anybody else.
Yep.
And increasingly, that's the way war is headed these days.
Mm-hmm.
It's different. That thing where we hang around and occupy and nation build, and that, you know, that just doesn't work like it used to. This isn't World War II anymore. You cannot win the 20th century war with battle strategies that came from D-Day. You just
right.
you can't. It's not going to work. And so I think there's a great fascination, and I know I had it. How is it that we get these guys? Where do they come from? How do we make them? Are they made? Are they born? How do you train them? How do you get people so they're able to do that kind of stuff? And so Rourke and I have been spending months together. I've been mm-hmm. out in San Diego where he is, out at in Coronado, which is where the SEALs are headquartered. And we've come up with this book. Hyperion is the publisher, ABC Disney, big publisher. It's coming out in February. And for the first time ever, really gets inside the mind of these guys. It's not just a gunfight movie. I mean, listen, there's a lot of shooting in the book, and, you know, doing raids and all that stuff. So if you like that bang bang, we've got plenty of bang bang for you.
Mm-hmm.
But there's lots of books that do that.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody before has ever really given you inside the way we create these guys. And so the book is called Damn Few, Making the Modern SEAL Warrior. And it's Rourke Denver and Ellis Hennick, and I hope people like it.
Oh, that sounds absolutely tremendous. And, again, that's been the nice thing about this as somebody, and as I told you off air, I've been a long-time person interested in special forces and what they do. It's really been great, I think, in the wake of the bin Laden mission last year to see people really kind of waking up to this great job here. I mean, and that's the thing, too. It's been a prolonged enough period of appreciation. You said the book will be out in February, but fortunately, this is a sustained wave, it seems like, from the public of really appreciating these figures. And as you indicated, for reasons of budget and otherwise, this is probably the future and where it's going anyway. So, you know, what a great thing for you to be able to write about.
Yeah, no, it's been a privilege for me to be involved and as close. I mean, frankly, they really have brought me right into their world, all their innermost thoughts, and I do believe what you said, which is that these are the modern warriors for the kinds of wars we're fighting today and are likely to be fighting for the decades to come. And mm-hmm. and the military is in a position of genuine reappraisal right now.
Mm-hmm.
How many people do we need? How much can we afford? What can we do? What shouldn't we be getting involved in? I mean, those are profound and deeply important questions.
Mm-hmm.
And right at the center of that discussion are the U.S. Navy SEALs, and they've done some of the biggest, highest profile Osama bin Laden, and the other one too that I think really helped put him on the map was that Somali pirate hostage case. Do you
yes.
remember that one where they grabbed the cargo captain, the
mayor
of Alabama?
Right? Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and the SEALs came in three sharpshooters, bang, bang, bang.
Yep.
And one of the things we say in the book, and I don't want to reveal too much yet, but is the way that mission created confidence in the current president and people around him that really led to the green lighting of the Osama bin Laden raid. Had it not been for the pirates, there may well not have been Osama bin Laden. And the way those things get stitched together and how that SEAL culture creates that and makes sure that when they send those guys, they can get it done is a fascinating and largely untold story.
What a wonderful tease for the book because, yeah, I've not heard anybody draw that line previously. So one more thing to look forward to with the book, how the line gets drawn between that mission and the bin Laden mission and how that plays out exactly. Yeah, that's what an interesting tidbit there. Between that, we touched on the voiceover work as well as your main work. Anything that that we haven't hit sufficiently that you're working on that we should?
What you got?
Well,
I need to keep at
it.
I think
this is we hit Fox, we hit Newsday, we hit By the way, speaking of which, if there were any concerns from your agent about the cartoon aspect of it, you could simply just say to him, "Did you see me bantering with Bill O'Reilly last week? What are you concerned about?"
You know, I'll tell you one final thing. Mostly those worlds, despite your efforts to the contrary, mostly those worlds are kind of separate. Right?
Okay.
The people that watch the Fox News Channel, by and large, are not looking at Adult Swim on the Cartoon Network, right?
I'm one of the rare crossover.
Right. But once in a while, I'll get an email, right? I'll do an O'Reilly hit or a Hannity thing, and I'll get an email from a 19-year-old stoned sophomore at the University of Illinois who will say, "Oh, my God, Stormy is my character. Stormy's on O'Reilly. It sounds just like him. Oh, my God, I can't believe it."
That's
hilarious. I'm like, you all are not supposed to know about each other. please stay in your own corners, you know?
How ironic is it that we're talking about this on the island of Manhattan? Because I'm thinking of George Costanza. Worlds are colliding.
Nah,
that's what's happening for you. Worlds are colliding.
I try to avoid it for the last. this media thing reveals all of your secrets.
It really does. But it's been a pleasure to follow everything that you've had going on, Ellis. And just as great to talk to you the second time around. And thank you so much for your hospitality, sir.
Sure. Happy to have you guys.
Appreciate it.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.